Good afternoon. We're ready for argument in the case of Feral Gas Inc. versus Yeiser, and the petitioner may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Tiffany Norton from the law firm of Central Gold Farb & Rice. At its core, this case involves public policy issues about whether Colorado wants to encourage or discourage settlement, whether Colorado wants to reward plaintiffs for seeking a double recovery, or whether it wants to reward parties who resolve claims. Those are the real fundamental issues here today. The three issues here today are the amount of the set-off that Feral Gas should receive for extinguishing a subrogated claim, whether Feral Gas is entitled to its costs, and whether interest should have been awarded on the verdict for a period of time. Overturning the Colorado Court of Appeals decision relating to these three issues is consistent with long-established Colorado public policy favoring settlements. Now, the very first issue for this court to decide is the amount that a person should receive when they extinguish a subrogated interest. Feral Gas is asking this court for a full set-off of the monies that Ms. Yeiser, the plaintiff's homeowner's insurance carrier, paid to her regarding a property damage claim. A full set-off will encourage defendants like Feral Gas to settle with subrogated interests such as Farmers Insurance, Ms. Yeiser's carrier, in the future. Ms. Yeiser, on the other hand, is asking this court to provide her with over a $39,000 windfall of money she unquestionably already received from her own insurance carrier. Just to provide the court with some brief background here, this is a breach of contract case. Feral Gas had a contract with Ms. Yeiser to deliver propane to her mountain vacation home outside Silverthorne. Feral Gas didn't timely deliver the propane, the heating system quit working, and there was water damage to the home. Feral Gas admitted liability, and the case went to trial on damages. Now, Farmers, Ms. Yeiser's homeowner's insurance carrier, after this loss occurred in November of 2000, paid Ms. Yeiser monies through October of 2001 related to the damage, and those damages are a little over $212,000. I'm not going to go down to the penny here, that's in the briefing, but that's the general gist of it. So in October of 2001, the farmers' monies were known to be $212,000. That essentially was the limit of Ms. Yeiser's insurance, unfortunately for her. At that point, Farmers then pursued a claim against Feral Gas, a subrogation claim seeking repayment of what it had paid to Yeiser. Now, Farmers and Feral Gas resolved that subrogated claim for a little over $172,000. Now, the claim was resolved in November of 2001 between Farmers and Feral Gas. Yeiser filed this lawsuit in 2003, seeking damages for amounts over and above her insurance that she claimed for property damage. There was serious question as to what damages were related. It was difficult to track the damages, so really a jury had to decide what was owing to her. The jury did decide in March of 2005 that Ms. Yeiser was awarded over $314,000.
What was the measure of damages that the jury was instructed to use in making its determination?
The jury was instructed to award Ms. Yeiser all damages pursuant to Jury Instruction 15, and not to subtract any monies received by Ms. Yeiser from Farmers or that...
I'm sorry, my question goes to, was this the replacement value?
No, it was cost of repair, Your Honor.
Cost of repair?
Yes.
And how much was... How, you said how much the amount was? Can you just repeat that?
Sure. The total amount of the jury verdict, including the nickels and dimes, is in the briefing, but it was around $314,000 for the verdict, Your Honor. Now, upon a post-trial motion from Feral Gas, the trial court subtracted the amount of money that Ms. Yeiser had previously been compensated by her homeowner's insurance carrier, Farmers.
Give us some math again. How much is that?
Sure, it's a little over $212,000, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the exact numbers, I mean, we have it down to the penny in the briefing.
So is that the set-off amount?
Yes, that was the set-off amount applied by the trial court.
Right. And the Court of Appeals didn't like that.
Right, the Court of Appeals did not like that. The Court of Appeals essentially said Ferrellgas was only entitled to a subtraction of the amount that Ferrellgas had paid farmers, which is the $172,000 amount.
Why shouldn't the plaintiff be able to recover that? And she's the one who procured the insurance. Ferrellgas didn't procure it. Why should Ferrellgas get the benefit of this discounted deal with the insurance company?
It's not really a question of Ferrellgas getting a deal. The question here, unlike the Tucker case where someone's claiming phantom damages, the issue here is what amount of compensation was received by Ms. Yeiser. That's the real core issue here. And it's irrelevant what Ferrellgas paid farmers to extinguish its lien. Because subrogation, the Court of Appeals noted this, and Justice Rivera, in his special concurrence in the Van Waters case, said that subrogation holds a very special place related to the collateral source rule, and that is to avoid parties such as Yeiser from obtaining a double recovery.
Can we get into the collateral source rule? Because am I right here, we're looking at the common law collateral source rule, we're not looking at the statute, right? Because this is just a contract claim, not a tort claim.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, okay. there are, understanding a little bit of history between the common law collateral source rule and the statute, if I can go into that for a few minutes.
How about you answer my question first?
Certainly.
Okay. And that is that doesn't the common law rule apply in this case?
Yes.
Not the statute.
That's correct.
Okay, so the statute's fine for background, but the common, as I understand the common law, the wronged party, the victim, was entitled to double recovery. So the presumption should be double recovery. Isn't that right?
Well, as common law, the plaintiff was entitled to a double recovery unless the monies that plaintiff received were attributable or identifiable with the defendant or payor. And that's the very situation that we have in this case. That's what the trial court determined. Under the common law rule, plaintiff is in fact entitled to a double recovery unless the monies that she received are somehow associated or identifiable with the defendant, which in this case they are, because Ferrellgas extinguished a subrogated claim.
Wait a minute, the money came from her insurance company.
That's correct.
Okay.
But what's left out of the equation here is the fact that Ferrellgas did, in fact, pay money to extinguish the claim that was pursued by Yeiser's carrier, who, there's no question that the bargain that was struck by Ferrellgas and farmers came at no expense to Ms. Yeiser. She still received the full amount of compensation from her own insurance carrier, $212,000.
So why isn't she entitled to the set off in the amount that Ferrellgas paid?
Because this court has previously determined when the payments made to the plaintiff are associated with or identified with the defendant, as they are in this case with Ferrellgas, the plaintiff is not entitled to a double recovery and the defendant is entitled to a set off.
But what's the policy basis for that? Just remind me, I don't understand that.
The policy basis?
Yeah. Well, why should Ferrellgas benefit at all?
Well, really everyone is benefiting by resolution of claims. The fact that Farmers was not a party to this action, the fact that the litigation was not more complex, the fact that we didn't have another party, the fact that there's not another party asserting issues, the fact that Ferrellgas and Farmers were able to come together and strike a bargain has nothing to do with the compensation that was received by Yeiser.
Talk to me a little bit about this standard identifiable with and how you would interpret that. I mean, it seems that at first blush at least, as perhaps is implied by the Chief Justice's question, one could say, well, it's not identifiable with Ferrellgas because it came from farmers. And while Ferrellgas did pay that subrogation claim and got a discount in doing that for perhaps some to some extent obvious reasons. Nonetheless, that sort of comes afterwards. And so how do you work identifiable with to either go to farmers, to the insurance, it was farmers, I think, or to instead to feral gas because it subsequently pays the segregation, which has nothing to do immediately with the monies that are received by the plaintiff, but of course subsequently takes care of the subrogation claim.
Well, I'm sorry, what was your question again?
So you're working this on identifiable with. I mean, you're saying this turns on identifiable with. So how do you interpret that to get to feral gas instead of simply getting to the insurance?
Well, that's one of the reasons why we're here today. In the Colorado Permanente case, the court did not say that the payer of the subrogated claim or the payer of the monies plaintiff had received had to be the same defendant. It just said identifiable with or associated with. And that was also the same language used in the Quinones case from the 10th Circuit. Essentially, whether it's a direct payment from the defendant to the plaintiff, or here we have kind of a circular payment where payments were made to Yeiser by her carrier. Her carrier then pursued a claim against Feral Gas, and plaintiffs unquestionably received those monies. So I don't think it's fair to say that Feral Gas is not associated in any way with the payments that Yeiser received here, when in fact Feral Gas paid quite a bit of money to extinguish the subrogated claim that farmers owned.
Colorado Permanente case, that was interpreting the statute, right?
It was interpreting the statute, but the interesting interplay in all of the cases interpreting the statute look to the common law. And essentially, what we have here is a framework where the Colorado Permanente case said under the contract exception to the collateral source statute, there was no direction as to what to do when the payments were attributable to the defendant. So this court then looked to the common law collateral source rule and determined that under the common law, when payments are associated with or attributable to the defendant, that plaintiff was entitled to a set off in those circumstances. So the case law examining the statute frequently, not only the Van Waters case, but also the Colorado Permanente case, frequently examines the common law collateral source rule as well. And if you think about it, really the contract exception under the statute to the statutory collateral source rule is akin to the common law collateral source rule. And under Colorado Permanente, the court said, look, when the payment's associated with the defendant, plaintiff is entitled to a set off, using the common law as a guide.
Counsel, before you move on, can I ask you just to follow up on this idea of the identifiable relation? I mean, is that question before us? Is that question before us? I mean, how are we, is that part of the cert question, or how is that part of the Court of Appeals opinion that is now being considered by us now?
Well, if you look at the issues on appeal, the first one is whether the Court of Appeals erred when determining petitioner was not entitled to the full value of a resolved subrogation interest. There's never really been a dispute that Feral Gas was associated with the payments that were made to farmers, that farmers then made to Yeiser. That's never really been a dispute, and in my view, is not really an issue before the court. The issue here is, having contributed two monies that Yeiser received, is Feral Gas entitled to the full amount of monies that Yeiser received, or is she entitled to the monies that Feral Gas paid to farmers?
Okay, so I guess your answer is that it's not in question here, that it was not cross-appealed, and you won that issue, didn't you, at the Court of Appeals level?
Yes, and there is no cross-petition in this case, and to my knowledge, there's no issue that Feral Gas is identifiable with monies that plaintiff received.
Thank you.
Let me just ask you the sequence. I thought the sequence was that farmers paid Ms. Yeiser and then Feral Gas paid farmers. Is that the sequence?
That's exactly what happened, Your Honor.
So there was no direct contact between the money changing hands between your client and Ms. Yeiser?
That's correct.
It just went from your client to farmers.
Right.
Okay.
But under Colorado law, the owner of a subrogated interest, such as farmers, has, they own that claim. They own the claim for the amount of monies that they paid out. And that can be resolved or, in this case, settled without plaintiff's involvement. If we have to have plaintiff's involvement in resolving every subrogated interest, I don't think that's going to provide incentives to settle, and it's certainly going to make things more complicated.
Say under Colorado law, be more specific, where does that come from?
Regarding?
You said they could recover the amount they paid, the insurance company. Let me back it up just a little. And I'm sort of curious about, we keep dancing around this term related to. What does it mean to be related to, and related to in what way? Maybe just to back up real fundamentally. So why does Ferrellgas pay back the insurance company to start with?
Because Farmers was threatening litigation against Ferrellgas. And in order to not pursue litigation between Farmers and Ferrellgas, both of the parties got together and resolved the case amicably. Because Farmers independently pursued its subrogation interest that it owns under Colorado law. And under, there's a case, D. Herrera v. American Family. And in that case, it says the insurer, when it has paid benefits to the plaintiff, has a right to go after the responsible party for those benefits. And that same case, D. Herrera at 219 Pacific 3rd, 246, states that this subrogation exists without the consent of the insured. And if you look at the Van Waters case, Justice Rivera wrote a special concurrence in that case, essentially saying that subrogation is very important regarding the collateral source rule. The underlying principle of the collateral source rule is, look, we shouldn't be permitting double recoveries.
When not true. Collateral source rule under common law permits double recovery.
When the payments are associated with or attributable to the defendant, Your Honor.
That's the caveat, but general principles that double payment.
That's correct, unless the payments that plaintiff received are attributable to the defendant. That was an exception to the common law collateral source rule.
You're stating it as a...
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Well, and Justice Rivera felt that in the instance of subrogation, that plaintiff would be compensated once, the carrier would be reimbursed, and the defendant would pay. And under those circumstances, this is a subrogation case. This is the very type of issue that Justice Rivera was forecasting, perhaps, when he wrote that special concurrence, that when subrogated interests are involved, what that subrogated interest gets paid is irrelevant to the amount of compensation received by the plaintiff.
So that's a straightforward application of saying she got all her repair costs. She was made whole, and what about the cost of the litigation for getting the jury award?
Ms. Geiser was made whole by Farmers up to the limits of her insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, she did claim that she was owed additional monies, but, you know, Ferrellgas has no...
Well, what did Ferrellgas pay her?
What did Ferrellgas pay her?
Yeah.
Well, at the end of the day, there's a judgment for $145,000 that's currently pending.
Well, it paid her the difference between what the judgment was against it and what the subrogated amount was, the $212.
Right, it was the amount of the verdict, $314 minus the $212,000.
So it was $101 judgment plus interest and cost, right?
That's correct. Actually, it was about $102,000, and the court entered judgment for $102,251.27 on 1/26/2006.
They could have subtracted the $172 instead of the $214, but you won that part.
Yes.
So the bigger number got subtracted.
That's correct.
And as I think Justice Ide alluded to, that's not before us. So we're not going to worry about that. I mean, whether we're not going to revisit whether it should have been 212 or 172. The 212 is now just the state of the case. Is that correct?
No, actually what happened was the trial court determined that Feral Gas was entitled to a subtraction of $212,000 because that was the amount of compensation received by plaintiff, and the trial court felt, consistent with cases from other jurisdictions, that the amount of compensation received by plaintiff was the amount to be subtracted.
Right.
Now, the Court of Appeals said the only amount of payment connected to Feral Gas, in essence, was the $172,000 that Feral Gas paid to extinguish the farmer's claim. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So we do have contradictory outcomes from the trial court and the Court of Appeals. Trial court said 212 set off, Court of Appeals said 172 set off. But in the equation at the Court of Appeals, the fact that there was a subrogation claim that was fully extinguished and Ms. Yeiser was fully compensated was not an issue that the Court of Appeals really addressed.
Okay, so the judgment in the district court was 101. The judgment out of the Court of Appeals is roughly 141. And that's all weighed against the final offer of 197. Is that right? Do we have our numbers right there?
Well,
it goes above that, right? Because of the interest and the cost?
We're not. Yeah, go ahead and answer that question.
Well, at trial, essentially, there was an offer of $197,000 from Feral Gas to farmers in December of 2004. And then the trial court took the $314,000 verdict, subtracted $212,000 from it, calculated interest, including interest for 2 years after the loss and interest on the verdict, which is another issue here, and entered judgment for $145,812. So even with several years of post-offer interest, which cannot be included under 1317-202, Feral Gas's offer of $197,000 was greater than the recovery realized by Yeiser. Now, the Court of Appeals essentially determined that Feral Gas had to somehow include the resolution of the subrogated interest in its offer of settlement. Now, for the first issue here is plaintiff never raised that issue to the trial court. If you look at the record, volume 3, 866 to 868, the only argument made by Yeiser in response to the offer of settlement issue was whether Feral Gas was entitled to a set-off. And the trial court noted this in its order dated February 27, 2006. So these arguments saying that the amount had to be included, that the farmer's subrogated interest that was resolved years earlier had to be included in the offer, was never made until the Court of Appeals. The other thing is that the Court of Appeals said we had to somehow include this offer so plaintiff could decide whether to take it under the Weeks case. Well, in Weeks, you had one plaintiff and one defendant and a bunch of plaintiffs. And essentially what Weeks said is if you have multiple plaintiffs, you can't say, here's $30,000, figure it out. You have to let each plaintiff know what number they're looking at, like A, B, and C, $10,000 each. That's not the case here. There's one plaintiff and one defendant. There's no question the subrogated interest was resolved. And comparing the verdict that was later subtracted to the amount of the offer, I submit is incorrect under the plain statutory language of 1317-202, which requires comparison between the offer and the final judgment. Now, final judgment can't be entered until subtractions are taken, including subtractions for the collateral source rule. And this could also arise in a situation of pro rata liability. The verdict is not always the amount of the judgment. And in this case, it wasn't. So we asked for the Court of Appeals decision there to be reversed. Now, on the last issue, the interest issue, Feral Gas contends that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals erred by permitting Yeiser interest on the verdict for a period of time. And this is the analysis there by both the Court of Appeals and the trial court. There was a claim in November 2000. In November 2001, Feral Gas paid farmers. So during that year, Ms. Yeiser should be entitled to interest. Now, Feral Gas submits how could it possibly pay farmers or anybody until Feral Gas had some idea, until it knew what farmers was going to pay? I mean, I'm not sure what the Court of Appeals is envisioning here. Someone just hand over a blank check and say, fill it out when you have an amount. I'm not sure. And the other thing is, under the statute 512.102, applying interest here, interest can only be permitted on amounts that are owing and wrongfully withheld to Yeiser. Money that was never paid to Ms. Yeiser could not possibly be wrongfully withheld to her. Therefore, Feral Gas asserts that the Court of Appeals erred when awarding interest to Ms. Yeiser on the verdict for a period of time. I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Counsel. I appreciate...
Excuse me, could you please give your name?
My name is Mark Bendinelli. I represent Ellen Yeiser, along with Tim Stoller from Bendinelli Law Office. Good afternoon. Feral Gas argues that the collateral source rule was meant to prevent double recovery, and as the Court noted, it was actually, the purpose was actually to encourage people to insure against a loss. And the common law developed by communicating to the public that they will not be punished by insuring against a loss. And as Justice Mularkey noted, the common law did not prevent double recovery. Rather, plaintiffs were allowed to recover full damages against defendants, even though the plaintiffs also received compensation from collateral sources. And that was noted in the Van Waters case. The issue is, in this case, should Ellen Yeiser have not procured homeowners insurance, the most benefit that Feral Gas could have received was the 172, because that's all they paid, was $172,000. So, but for, it would be a punishment for Ms. Yeiser to allot Feral Gas a greater benefit than what they actually paid. So if there was no
punishment
in this case,
you characterize that as a punishment. I don't understand why.
I'm not saying a punishment, but I mean, Feral Gas would receive no benefit. No additional benefit. They would not. They would be liable for 100% of the loss. And in essence, by only crediting them with $172,000, which is what they paid farmers, they are not paying more than the damages that the jury determined that there were, which was the $315,000.
No, I think I at least am having a little trouble just getting this all sorted out. So you think that Feral Gas should have had to pay the 172 because that's what they actually ended up paying farmers, as opposed to the 212 that farmers actually ended up paying Yeiser. Is that right?
Correct.
And you think they should have done that because that's all the money they spent, so that's all they should get the set off for.
Right. It says, the case law says, if there is a collateral source, a source of indemnity for the plaintiff that was procured by the injured party, the wrongdoer can never sustain some type of benefit from that or use that to diminish the damages that they ultimately caused. They can't use her benefits to reduce their damages.
So you're saying farmers walked away with $40,000 on the deal? I mean, they didn't, right?
I'm sorry?
Well, you're saying farmers made some money on that deal because they were able to subrogate or get more back against the judgment against Feral than they would have if they'd used the 212 number.
Well, actually, it was Feral Gas that
that's
made it.
That's what I meant to say, yes.
Yes, yes. And, when you look at the insurance policy, Ellen Yeiser always was the real party in interest. She was the injured party. And case law says that an insurer, through subrogation, can't divest an insured of those rights until and unless the insurance carrier owned 100% of the subrogation interest. Farmers cannot place their interest in front of Ellen Geisers to recover the damages, nor can Feral Gas deal with an ancillary party who is not the real party in interest and attempt to gain the, you know, what they call the benefit of the bargain, which really divests the real party in interest of the benefits that she purchased through insurance.
Counsel, can I just follow up on that very question? I mean, you started by saying that the collateral source rule allowed double recovery, correct?
Correct.
We were perfectly comfortable with it. But then somehow this set off comes to play. Now, I mean, what's to keep you from arguing, I guess, that there should be no set off here whatsoever? Is that, I mean, is that kind of where your position leads, that there should not be any set off at all? Because she, I guess under your initial argument, she was wise enough to go out and get insurance, and she shouldn't be punished for that. She should be able to keep both recoveries, shouldn't she?
Well, ironically, the Phil, that cites no authority for a result otherwise than what you just proposed. Nonetheless, we conceded at the trial court level that Feral Gas should not be deprived any credit of monies that they actually paid, although the court is correct in saying that there's no authority for a result to the contrary.
Is the suggestion, just intuitively, if I'm not really on authority here, the reason why we're not going to make Feral Gas pay twice here what they already paid is because we don't just have an insurance arrangement between Geiser and Farmers, but rather we have an insurance arrangement that allows Farmers to go after Feral Gas for the amount that they paid Geiser? Is that in effect, at least intuitively, if we can't pin it down to positive law here, an assignment in this arrangement between Geiser and Farmers of her, of the amount she was paid by Farmers? Is that $2,012 or whatever it was, $212,000 now, Farmers claim rather than Geiser's?
Exactly. And in fact, we addressed that in the brief, talking about the difference between a subrogation interest and an assignment. For Feral Gas to argue that Farmers owned Ms. Geiser's claim, there would have had to be an assignment between the insured and Farmers. Because as the case law says, in this case where an insured is not divested of his or her cause of action, either by payment to the insurer of a sum substantially less than the insured's loss, or by the execution of a subrogation receipt, when the insured remains the real party of interest. Farmer's interest was ancillary to Ms. Geiser, so there was no assignment. Ms. Geiser, there was no privity. She didn't. She was not alerted as to these negotiations, nor did she participate in them, nor did she sign a release.
I guess maybe one follow-up question on that is, and so where does Farmer's subrogation right come from here?
Well, in the contract, in the insurance.
And so has she made a contract with Farmers by which, in effect, she's given away a claim or assigned a claim to Farmers for the amount that Farmers pays her?
That's true, yet in the context of a collateral source, that those rights, those contracted rights through the privity between Farmers and Ellen Geiser can't interpose itself onto the circumstance really to circumvent the collateral source rule.
Spinatelli?
Benedetti.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
What was it? I apologize.
You know what? That was better than most.
All right. you can correct me as you did with your name. My understanding was that the collateral source rule, a common law collateral source rule, had an exception when the amount was paid by the defendant tortfeasor.
That's correct.
And that would be for the precise amount paid, not
Exactly.
So why doesn't that apply here? And that's what...
Well, it does, and that's what we're arguing. We're not saying that...
No. I'm sorry, I didn't say it correctly. I thought it applied to the amount that's accepted by the insurer.
No, actually, there's a case cited in our brief that says that... there is no case law right on point. However, we do have some direction from 10-4, I think it's 202 that we cited in the brief, and that's the voluntary payer statute. Now, that also is related to tort, and that's under Title 10. But what it says is that when a wrongdoer injures a tortfeasor and there is a prepayment prior to either a final settlement or a verdict, number one, that payment is not an admission of liability. And number two, ultimately, they will receive credit for the amounts actually paid. Under no circumstances can a wrongdoer receive more credit than what they actually pay. Especially when, to do so, they're appropriating the benefits paid for by the injured party. And that's, in essence, what Farmers with Feral Gas has done here. Feral Gas approached Farmers, circumvented the real party in interest to attempt to avail themselves on some unfair advantage based on Ms. Yazzer's benefits. And if they are only credited the $172, which they actually paid, and that is reduced from the verdict, then Feral Gas ultimately will pay for 100% of the loss and not paying more. What Feral Gas is attempting to do is to receive about a 21% discount based on the insured's benefits, which is a collateral source. And, hence our argument that they can't avail themselves to her benefits because her benefits are a collateral source.
It seems to me one of the problems I'm having is there's something in addition to the collateral source problem. The collateral source is a collateral source from Ms. Yazzer. She's getting more money from a collateral source. The only reason that Feral Gas is paying any money, making a settlement or paying any money to Farmers, is because Farmers has a claim against Feral Gas as a result of its contract with Ms. Yazzer.
That's correct.
That's true. So
that's a derivative from the permanent contract between Ms. Yazzer and Farmers. It's a derivative right. It's not a claim. But nonetheless, Feral Gas is still attempting to resolve their liabilities to Ms. Yazzer.
So that's where I'm kind of going to the last loop of this, back to the initial part of our argument. So what does it mean to be related under the collateral source rule here? Well, is this the type of thing that they have in mind if what's going on is Feral Gas is not, it's not just a question of Ms. Yazzer getting money from another source, but rather Feral Gas has to pay another source as a result of Ms. Yazzer's arrangements with that source? Is that the kind of relation that we're talking about in the collateral source rule to prevent this additional payment by Feral Gas?
Well, it's not an additional payment because the result reached by the Court of Appeals, under no circumstances would Feral Gas ever be responsible for more than the damages. But I understand the question.
And let me just follow it up with one slight twist on it. If we didn't have this contract, And Feral Gas were dealing with Ms. Yazzer entirely, it could have reached a settlement with her for less than the amount, presumably, that she might have gotten in a jury verdict. That's in effect what it's done with her. They're not technically an assignee, but
right,
with the insurance company that's paid and now has her claim.
Right, but what Feral Gas did is induce Farmers into an arrangement which she ultimately, being the real party in interest, has a final determination whether she is going to agree to some type of reduction of that claim. And her contract with Farmers should not have divested her of the final rights to make those type of decisions because she is the real party in interest. She did not benefit from the arrangement and the agreement between Feral Gas and Farmers. She's the one who created the benefit. And Ferrellgas and Farmers are off the sidelines. She's the real party of interest, and they're using her benefits and to reach some agreement to which she's not a party. She did not agree, and there was no assignment.
Well, but in effect, contractually, she gave up something in order to get the payment from Farmers, didn't she? Contractually, didn't. Is it fair to say that she gave up her claim to those $212,000 because Farmers, under the insurance contract, gets to go after Ferrellgas for that amount?
That's an interesting question, and I would say the answer ultimately may be yes, but not before there's an adjudication on the merits, because the jury got to hear, I mean, if you want to go there, that her claim was somehow not worth dollar for dollar. You know, I mean, you know, for every $10 she spent, she should only recover $8. So really, she was hurt in the trial court from that arrangement, and ultimately, the verdict was hundreds of thousands of dollars less than she actually spent out of her pocket with the money that she got from Farmers. So there's just something wrong with this arrangement being done before trial. This evidence was admitted. And we believe devalued her claim in front of the jury, and only because she had the foresight to purchase insurance. Again, under a circumstance where Ellen Nazar does not buy insurance, Ferrellgas gets no more benefit than the $172 they paid prior to trial. and the collateral source line of cases always end with, to the extent that the plaintiff can get a double recovery. It always ends with, nonetheless, this can never be used to diminish the obligor's liability, ultimate responsibility. They can never use a collateral source to somehow mitigate their responsibility to somehow pay less than 100% of the harm that they caused. And that's in the Van Waters case.
If that means that then Ferrellgas can't argue, because the insurance company gave you a certain amount of money, that I don't have to pay you. That we'd sort of all agree, the collateral source rule says Ferrellgas can't benefit that. Is that complicated by the fact that now the insurance company is permitted by a separate arrangement to come after Ferrellgas?
But Ellen Nazar is not bound by it, and Ferrellgas circumvented her and dealt with Farmers at their own peril. And she is not bound by the terms that they reached based on the collateral source that she created by her premiums. And that's the whole point, that she's not bound by their arrangement. And the Court of Appeals, we think, followed the collateral source rule and progeny of cases perfectly. And it was the opinion to that regard was unassailable. With the remaining time, and I don't know how much time I have, I'll move on to the other two issues that were accepted as for today's discussion. The final judgment versus the statutory offer. Someone had asked, I think it might have been Justice Rice, whether this really makes a difference as to whether the plaintiff prevailed on the statutory offer. The answer is yes. If Ellen Nazar gets her verdict minus the 172, she has prevailed. She's the prevailing party as it relates to the statutory offer. Therefore, this is a big deal. And the case that was cited and attacked by Ferrellgas, Ferrellgas attempted to distinguish that case, saying that, well, there were multiple parties.
I guess my math, I'm just confused at this point. If she gets the verdict minus the 172, it's roughly...
It's the interest.
Okay, it's roughly 40, how much, something, 40?
$40,000.
Okay. If she gets the
interest and cost.
She gets the verdict minus the 212, it's roughly 101 plus interest and cost. But under either scenario, it's not more than 197.
Yes, under the where Ferrellgas only received the 172, the amount that they paid with the interest and costs, it exceeded the 197, because the offer said with, you know, inclusive of interest and cost. So this will make a difference.
But couldn't have been too close. I mean, what were the final numbers? It had to be like within a few thousand.
Well, if you take the verdict of 315 minus 172, that's about $140,000.
Right.
Plus the interest and cost to put it up to about 210.
Does it go all the way up to 210?
Yes.
So that would get it in comparison to the 197.
And as we're in support of the fact that the statutory offer was not made in such a way as to the as to whether Ellen Lazar could intelligently formulate a decision whether to accept it or not, Farrell Gas filed a motion in limine prior to trial saying that this issue, whether it's really 172 or whether it's 212, we will talk about that post-verdict. So if Farrell Gas didn't know whether the appropriate amount of set-off, or at least there was some argument between the parties as to the appropriate amount of set-off, then how could the statutory offer have been made in such a way that didn't create a $40,000 difference? And the Court of Appeals agreed and said that this offer was not made in a manner whereby a party could intelligently understand the risks and benefits to make a thoughtful decision. As to the interest, we believe that the trial court got it right. The issue here is, and what Farrell Gas, I think, is missing in their analysis is, why should they get credit for the 172 that was reduced until they expended that money? And, you know, their argument was that, well, you should do it on just the 145, you know, from the date that the action accrued. But the way the interest is calculated is, it was on the 315 of the verdict until the date that the 172 was actually expended by Farrell. And then it was adjusted accordingly. And that's the way the Court of Appeals found that the interest calculation should have worked. And we obviously agree with that opinion.
Is that the last issue on cert?
It is.
The third issue.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Good time.
I want to address a few issues, the first one being subrogation issues that were raised by Justice Coates. At no point has plaintiff ever questioned the subrogation interest of farmers until the briefing with this court. Not at the trial court level, not at the Court of Appeals. The subrogation interest has never been questioned, and that's not really an issue that's part of the cert issues before this court. Now, there's no dispute farmers had a viable subrogation interest. Now, Justice Coates, you're correct that there's actually a case, a Supreme Court case, it's the mid-century case, 982 Pacific 2nd, 310, that says the amount of benefits paid by an insurance carrier, such as farmers, is assigned to the insurance carrier for collection. Now, if you look at the De Herrera case at 219 Pacific 3rd, 246, and these are all in Farrell Gas's briefs, it says that the subrogated interest, in this case farmers, has a right to collect those monies without any consent from the insured. That's part of the subrogation interest in and of itself, part and parcel. Now, as far as the collateral source issue.
Let me just ask you this question. I mean, farmers obviously didn't have to settle its subrogation interest. And in doing so, it put itself in a little bit of a risky position, did it not? I mean, it paid out more than it settled for, obviously.
Well, actually, I don't view it that way.
Okay.
I think farmers and Farrell Gas both struck a bargain that was beneficial to both of them. Farmers didn't have to pay for 7 years of litigation, for example, that's gone on in this case. They didn't have to retain an attorney. They got a lion's share of their money back, and they were happy with that arrangement. Now, cases from other jurisdictions have determined that in circumstances where subrogated interest is paid, it's not the amount of compensation that was paid to extinguish the lien that's important. The issue that's important is what is the amount of money that was received by the plaintiff. Because here, Ms. Yeiser is asking you for almost a $40,000 windfall of money she already got from her carrier. Now,
this doesn't that benefit Ferrellgas? They got the benefit of the bargain.
Right, but the benefit of Ferrellgas's bargain has nothing to do with the amount of compensation received by Yeiser. The benefit of the bargain between farmers and Ferrellgas was not done at the expense of Ms. Yeiser, who still received the full $212,000.
That's right, until we start subtracting that money. I mean, the only person who's paying out to both is Ferrellgas and also Ferrellgas to farmers and Ferrellgas to Pfizer, if you want to continue with this sort of circular analogy that you're saying. And so when Ferrellgas paid out to farmers, it paid out less than what Farmer did, but it benefited. And farmers went along with that deal. They said that was okay.
Right, it benefited both parties, actually. And in a way, it benefited Yeiser, too, because the case was simplified. There were fewer parties, fewer issues, although we still ended up here. Now, the other issue here is on the cost issue. Whether a plaintiff prevails or not, it's a domino in this case regarding what this court rules. Now, plaintiff's calculation on interest depends on, is interest permitted on the verdict for a period of time? That's included in his interest calculation. And, you know, what is the subtraction? So there's many issues interplaying here, like dominoes, as far as who's ultimately going to be the party that prevails under the offer of settlement statute. And to encourage settlement, to encourage parties to settle, Ferrellgas asked that this court overturn the Court of Appeals decision denying Ferrellgas the full value of its subrogated interest and awarding Ferrellgas costs and also disallowing Ms. Yeiser interest on the verdict for a period of time. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.